From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new film American Honey won the Cannes Film Festival's Jury Prize this year. It's about a group of teenagers who are abandoned or homeless and travel together by van from town to town, selling magazine subscriptions door to door. Today we'll talk with the film's writer and director, Andrea Arnold. The cast is a mix of actors and kids off the street.
We call it street casting, where we just go out. We get some of those deck chairs and sit outside Walmart and like watch all the kids go by. And that's how we found all of them, really.
Also, we talk about the FXX series, You're the Worst.
So, what you heard about me?
Nothing, just that you're the worst.
Says the girl who just stole a blender from a wedding.
Our guest will be the series creator, Stephen Falk, and its co-star, Aya Cash. And John Powers will review the new HBO series, Westworld. That's on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie American Honey, which won the jury prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival, was written and directed by my guest, Andrea Arnold. It's about a group of teenagers who are abandoned or homeless and have become something of a family, traveling together by van from town to town, state to state, selling magazine subscriptions door to door, making up different explanations depending on who opens the door. Arnold first learned about magazine crews, or mag crews as they're called, from a New York Times article about them. The stars of the film include Riley Keough, who plays the magazine crew's hardened boss, and Shia LaBeouf, who's her enforcer and most smooth-talking salesman. They both give terrific performances, but most of the cast is comprised of teenagers with no acting experience, including the lead, Sasha Lane, who plays a girl who runs away and joins the mag crew. Andrea Arnold also directed Fish Tank and Wuthering Heights, as well as several episodes of the series Transparent. Let's start with a scene from American Honey. The Sasha Lane and Shia LaBeouf characters are going door to door. It's her first time doing this, and he's telling her to ignore the sheet of sales tips she was told to memorize and take his advice instead.
You read the handbook last night? You know about the five sales steps?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of all that. You don't got to listen to that. See, because in Jake's book, there's one step. Not five, just one. Just takes one step. Once you get this one step down, you're the chief of the tribe. And I'm going to teach you that one step today. You know what I'm saying? Basically, as soon as they open that door and look at you, that's the critical moment. That's the make or break moment. Because in that second, you got to work them. You got to read them. You got to be able to scan them and figure them out. Figure out what kind of person that person wants in their life. Then you got to be that person. You know, it's like a couple of the other agents are really rigid about the five sales steps and all this shit. So they'll pick a spiel that's like some sad shit, like mama's got cancer, or my foot is falling off, I'm trying to get my life back together, you know, I got a little lost there in my teens and I'm really working on myself, man, and oh, you know, my dad, he died in Iraq, any sad spiel, and they'll just say it over and over and over again until it's meaningless. This person doesn't give a about magazines, right? They want something from me. So if I'm a G, I'm going to figure out what that something is, and I'm going to work that.
Yeah?
And that's a power agent. All right, let's go. You're my good luck charm. Here we go.
Andrea Arnold, welcome to Fresh Air. So this movie is inspired by real magazine crews, like mag crews. Some of the actors that you cast, we're not professional actors. I think most of the kids in the mag crew are actors. Were any of them people who had been in a mag crew selling magazines door to door?
Well, one of our girls, Nadia, she'd been in a mag crew. She was really good at it because at the very beginning, first we got them all together, we sent them out. And we had somebody from a mag crew come teach them how to sell. And then I sent them out like selling just to see how they would do. And Nadia was pretty good at that.
So what stories did you hear from the one person who you cast who had actually done this sort of work?
When we were casting, it was a different thing. It was always much briefer kind of interactions with people. So I never really asked her that much about it before we started, and then we're off filming. But I had chatted a lot to people who had done it before, so I heard a lot of things. One of the girls I met, she literally came out of jail, and she was standing at a gas station, and a mag crew kind of rolled in to get some gas, and they said, do you want to come with us? And that was it. She was gone, you know. She went because she had nothing to lose. And she stayed for a long time. And she had a lot of stories. I mean, she had, you know, she experienced some quite bad things, but she also made money and she made friends. And she stayed for a long time. She told me that actually towards the end, which I think this happens because a lot of the managers in the mag crews have been people who have been in the mag crew for a long time, and then they become managers. They're people who are good at it and then become managers. She said that she hit someone at one point because they hadn't sold very much. And at that point, she realized that she suddenly kind of questioned herself, like, how, oh, I've gone too far. You know, like, what's happening? Why am I doing, you know, how did I get here? And that is the thing that I think made her leave in the end, is that she turned into something she wasn't happy about.
So the people who actually subscribe to the magazines through the teenagers who are in these mag crews, do they ever get the magazine? Is the whole thing a scam? Or is there actually a magazine that's delivered in the end?
Some people get the magazine, some people don't. That's my understanding. And I think a lot of the people I met who had met the mag crews, when they bought the magazines, they were really trying to help the person that was in front of them. They were not thinking of really about the magazines. They were not. I mean, I must have bought at least 7, you know, subscriptions, but I never got one. But I don't think anyone's... I think my sense is that most people are not expecting to get them.
The main character, the teenage girl who's named Star in the film, she's kind of seduced into joining the group by the Shia LaBeouf character, who realizes that she's probably poor and unrooted. And he kind of plays the potential boyfriend to her and kind of seduces her to come along. And then the head of the crew, a woman who is played by Riley Keough, who is Elvis Presley's granddaughter, and she's terrific in this. She says to Star, "You got anyone who'll miss you?" And Star says, "No." And so the head of the crew says, "Okay, you're hired." And that just seems so key, like being seduced into it and then making sure that there's no one who's going to miss you, to make sure that that means that you're vulnerable and also that no one's going to come looking for you.
Yeah, that I felt when all the people I talked to, that was pretty... I'm actually really happy you picked up on that little moment, because that was really important to me, the no one's going to miss you thing. That was my sense from talking to a lot of these kids, and what I read is that there was no one going to miss them and they were not leaving very much behind. And then they would find these people the same age, and they would stay in the same hotels and they'd party and they'd see things. So it was kind of a mixed thing. They had good time, but it was also not an easy time for some of them. So
there's a scene in the film where Star, who was the young teenage girl who was seduced into joining this group, it's the Shia LaBeouf character, Jake, who kind of lures her in. And, you know, they have sex together, and she's kind of got a thing for him now. But she has to report to Crystal, who's the really hardened, tough woman who runs the crew. So she knocks on Crystal's motel room door, and Crystal starts, like, telling her what to do. And then she realizes that Jake is there, too. And then as Crystal's kind of ordering, you know, telling Star what she has to do, she basically tells Jake that she wants him to do her legs. So he has to take out the lotion, crouch down, and start massaging her legs with lotion, which is a very kind of sexual act, because she's wearing either a bathing suit or a bikini or underwear. I'm not sure which it is.
Confederate bikini.
Yes, right. And so it's this really strange power scene where the Crystal character, the crew manager, is showing her power over the Shia LaBeouf character. And she's also showing the teenage girl, who's now a part of the crew, that she's going to be dominated too. How did the image come to you of getting Shia LaBeouf on his knees, massaging, lotioning the legs of the crew leader?
I just want to need to get one of your facts straight. It's fake tan.
Oh, it's fake tan? I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's fake tan.
Oh, I thought it was body
And there's a
lotion.
Scene after and Star says, "You didn't wash your hands," because Jake has like fake tan on, you know, orange hands. With all of my scenes, when I go into them, I don't really know what's going to happen. And when I'm writing them, I mean, when I was writing that scene, I didn't kind of expect that to happen. And then I was thinking, well, Crystal, what's she doing? Oh, she's like putting fake tan on, and just thought, oh, Crystal's been to the shops. She's like bought a load of stuff. She's trying things on. She's like buys clothes all the time because she's not happy with herself. So she's constantly kind of buying clothes to try and, you know, make up for the things she doesn't feel good about. And she wants to look brown all the time. So Jake's in there, and you can't do your fake tan yourself very easily. So she's got Jake doing it. And when I wrote that, I thought, well, this is kind of strange. And I think even when we were doing it, everyone was thinking, wow, how's this going to work? Because it's kind of such a strong image. But I just went for it. I've always kind of taken risks, I guess, with these things. I never know how they're going to work out. I don't know when we go into that scene how it's going to work out. I think, yeah, this is kind of, this is a little strong, but I'm going to go with it. I don't feel that safe when I'm making scenes. I think, oh, maybe it's going to work, maybe it's not, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrea Arnold. She wrote and directed the new film American Honey. Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Andrea Arnold. She wrote and directed the new film American Honey. I'm interested in your approach to casting, especially the casting of the teenagers who were not professional actors. How do you go looking for them when you're not putting out a casting call?
I mean, I do this pretty much on almost all my films. This is how I do things. I'm always casting a mixture of actors and non-actors, and we do something called... We call it street casting, where we just go out. Sometimes I don't go out at the very beginning. I work with casting directors, and they are kind of people who have done this before, and they will go out to like places where the kind of people we're looking for might hang out. So they'll go, like for this film, they went out to like county fairs, or they go to Walmart, and they would just sit around and like look for people that might be the right kind of people for the film. So it's, you know, it's a really different way of casting. It's actually far more complicated and hard work, and actually the people who do it are amazing. And I get really into it, so I go out too, and I've done quite a lot of it myself. You know, we get some of those deck chairs and sit outside Walmart and, like, watch all the kids go by. And that's how we actually found Sasha. I mean, that's how we found all of them, really. It was pretty much that way.
Wait, so walk me through this. You're sitting in a chair outside the Walmart, watching the kids go by, looking for somebody to cast in your film. What do you tell them so that you don't sound totally crazy and that you don't sound like, you know, a pervert trying to get them into some kind of trap?
I mean, normally at the beginning we might do some kind of general casting call, which is on the internet. And usually that looks pretty legitimate, so we can show them that and say, look, this is a real thing.
Right.
We sometimes have some real convincing to do because they think you're just... You know, when we found Sasha, she was on a beach in spring break, and there are quite a few kind of people going around looking for girls to be in porn films. And
exactly.
Exactly. And so, you know, I completely am on the side of them when we go up to them. I want them to feel safe. I don't want them to feel... kind of weirded out by us, you know. So we do everything we can to kind of make them feel comfortable and show them things that I would never expect them to come with us unless they felt comfortable. So we show them things, we show the casting call, we have leaflets, you know, we have numbers they can call, you know. So we do our utmost to make them feel safe. I wouldn't want it any other way, actually, because I wouldn't want them to be feeling unsafe and coming with us, you know. So, and usually when we take it any further, if we meet them, say, in spring break, we'd meet them on the beach and we'd say, oh, look, we're going to do some auditioning up at Walmart car lot later, you know, and which is where we did most of our auditioning. So Walmart car lot in spring break down Panama City Beach is just rocking. It's just such a great place to be. I loved hanging out there because it's such a lot of, there's a lot of life going on there, a lot of twerking. I still can't twerk. I've been trying. Have you ever tried to twerk? It's so hard.
Me? No, I have never tried to twerk.
Some people can move one cheek different to the other. I don't know how the hell you do that. It's so clever.
So since I don't have the answer to that, let me ask you another question. So your 2009 film, Fish Tank, also starred a teenage girl who wasn't a professional actress. And she plays a teenager whose mother is an alcoholic and pays little attention to her. And the mother has a new boyfriend played by Michael Fassbender. And through kind of teasing and flirtation and teaching her how to use his video camera, Michael Fassbender's character eventually seduces the teenage girl into having sex with him. It's a kind of complicated relationship, all wrong. Why did you want to make a film about this kind of relationship?
Yeah, but see, you're talking about stuff that I can't possibly talk about because... you know, when I make films, I don't want to be discussing these things because I feel like, one, they're really personal, and two, they're really complicated, and I wouldn't want to try and uncomplicate them for anybody who was about to see the film. So to try and sit here and explain it, for me, would sort of unravel some of the mystery of it, and I think the mystery in films is really important, and that if we try and explain things too much, then you take out the fun of the film. For me, the space and the, you know, if people go see Fish Tank, I would love them to not know. I wouldn't want to explain to them what I kind of intended or what I felt were the intentions of each of those characters. I think that that has to unravel in the film. And I leave room for people to put themselves or to work it out or to go and argue in the bar afterwards. But if I explain it, I feel like then we take the mystery of film away. And I feel like we over-explain everything in life. And I'm desperate to leave a little mystery in what I do, even though it's tough, but I'm desperate to leave it.
So the two films of yours that I've seen, Fish Tank and your new film, American Honey, are about teenagers with a focus on teenage girls who have little or no affection from their mothers. Their mothers have alcohol or drug problems. They're both broke. I'm wondering what your teen years were like. You grew up in what in America is called a housing project. So tell us a little bit about what your home was like.
Ah, so that's so personal. I put all this stuff in my film so that I don't, you know, I can't talk about those things. I'm sorry.
Okay, so you don't want to talk about your
life?
Yeah.
Well, because my family are alive, and so, you know, I wouldn't want to talk about those things. It's really, you know, my mum was a single mum, and there were four of us, and must have been incredibly tough for her. So, yeah, I can't talk about that. I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's your call.
Yeah.
Both of those films that I mentioned, Fish Tank and American Honey, are about teenage girls.
Yeah.
Who need a way out of the situation that they're in. And in American Honey, the way out is joining this magazine crew. And in Fish Tank, what she thinks is going to be her way out is dancing. She wants to become a professional dancer, and she's always, you know, practicing her moves and everything. You were a dancer, right? In England?
A little bit, not like in any huge professional sense.
I thought you danced on Top of the Pops, the pop
music
show.
Yeah, that wasn't that professional.
No, really?
Yeah, it wasn't kind of, I've always loved dancing all my life, but I've never been trained in any way. So most of my kind of dancing in those early days was kind of things where you didn't have to have any kind of ballet training. And I remember going for an audition for Cats, which I thought maybe all you have to do is go around the stage like a cat, you know, be like a cat. So I went to that audition and I thought, I'm just going to go around the stage like a cat and just do my own sort of version of a cat. And of course, everyone there is doing kind of like pliés and official kind of thing. And I'm going around with my paws out, trying to be a cat. It must have been hilarious to watch. I can't imagine. But you know, those kind of experiences made me not want to go near any of them ever again, because there's something quite vulnerable about going around the stage like a cat and everyone else is doing their ballet. So, you know, I got a place at a really good dance school. I actually got a place, but I needed to get a grant in order to go there because it was away from home, and I wasn't able to get a grant because I hadn't done ballet and stuff. So I never officially did it, but I was always dancing. I've always found ways to dance, wherever life has taken me. I dance just basically all the time now. I dance all the time.
Now, I read that you hosted a couple of teen shows in England. There were shows that I hadn't heard of because I don't think they've been on in the U.S. So can you describe those shows for us?
One of the one I did mostly for a long time, I was very young when I started it. I was about 18 and I just left home and I didn't know how I was going to, like, you know, live my life, what I was going to do. And I just went to the audition kind of because I saw it and I thought it might be a way of, I'd been kind of done a lot of acting at school and it's something that I'd loved doing and felt that might be some way in which I could earn a living. So I went to an audition just out of the blue, and I somehow got it. I don't know how the hell I got it, but I did, and I ended up doing it for quite a few years. And it was a great thing for me because I earned money for the first time, and there was a gang of people that worked on it, you know, that I became really close to. It was like a huge family. I got to meet people and do things and travel and see the world, and it was a huge experience for me at that time, and opened up my eyes to so many things. I learned so much about cameras and about putting things together and all the kind of things that I use now in what I do. So it was tremendous training and a very good kind of, it was home for me for a long time, and I, you know, was very lucky to have landed there.
You seem particularly interested in making movies about teenagers, and in the hopes that you might be able to answer this, I'm going to ask you why the teenage years are especially interesting for you.
I don't know. People ask me that all the time. I always think every time I work on a project, I've kind of got to work something out for myself. So, I think it's... you know that if I make another film and it's about kind of people who are 60, that maybe I've worked some stuff out at last. I don't know. I'm always impressed when filmmakers know exactly what they're doing. I think, how do they know? How do they have themes and they want to make a thing about this? And I think, wow, I wish I was like that. I just don't know why I'm like obsessed with this particular image or this story, and I'm trying to unravel it and work it out. It's complicated.
Andrea Arnold, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Andrea Arnold directed the new film American Honey. After a break, we'll hear from the creator of the FXX comedy series You're the Worst, Stephen Falk, and the series co-star Aya Cash. And John Powers will review the new HBO series Westworld, which premieres Sunday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Home Instead Senior Care, offering professional in-home care, support, and resources for families dealing with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, including hands-on training for family caregivers. More at homeinstead.com/NPR. And from Day Street Books, publisher of The Fortress by Danielle Trussoni, author of Falling Through the Earth and Angelology. The Fortress is a memoir of love and loss in France that explores the other side of the romantic fairy tale, wherever books are sold.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the cable network FXX announced it was renewing its series You're the Worst for a fourth season. When it premiered in 2014, many critics called it one of the best new shows on TV. The series was created by our guest Stephen Falk, who serves as the executive producer. He was also co-executive producer of the Netflix series Orange is the New Black and the Showtime series Weeds. You're the Worst is sort of an anti-romantic comedy about Gretchen, played by our other guest, Aya Cash, and Jimmy, played by Chris Gere. They live in L.A. and are both fairly successful at their jobs. Gretchen is a music publicist. Jimmy published a novel that was a critical success but didn't sell very well. He's working on his next novel. They're brash and self-centered and have been unsuccessful with relationships. In the first episode, they meet for the first time outside a wedding reception. Jimmy has just been thrown out of the party because he caused a scene with the bride, who's his ex-girlfriend, Gretchen is leaving the wedding with a gift in her arms.
You got another one of those?
Pretty expensive.
Good job in there.
Getting married doesn't remove you from the burden of having to act like a human being.
Totally. Those two are doomed.
Right? Has any couple ever had a more dishonest start to a marriage? I mean, the balls to have a traditional Catholic ceremony.
When she's already had two abortions. Mm.
You're pretty.
Thanks.
How do you know her?
I'm friends with the sister.
Friends of Fat Lindsay?
Yeah, me and Fat Lindsay are hella close.
So, what you heard about me?
Nothing, just that you're the worst.
Says the girl who just stole a blender from a wedding.
No. Really? Oh, man! Thought it was a food processor.
Who's the worst now?
Yeah, well.
After a one-night stand where they reveal to each other all of the horrible things they've done, they decide to start a relationship. Although the show is a comedy, it's been praised for how it deals with issues like clinical depression, the death of a parent, and PTSD, the subject of last night's episode. Stephen Falk and Aya Cash spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado.
Stephen Falk, Aya Cash, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Stephen Falk, you're the creator of You're the Worst. How did you first sell the show when you were trying to get it made?
I went into FX and basically said, I was always a big fan of Mad About You, which was like a NBC show when I was in high school and early college, I think. And I found it really romantic. It was a long-term depiction of a marriage in this case, but of a relationship. And it was really kind of went through the minutiae of the day-to-day of that kind of stuff. It was like a rom-com in slow motion. And I was always fascinated by that. And so I went in, and then I was also sort of had become really fascinated by British sitcoms and the fact that the Brits tend to allow for actual humanity in their characters and not to require their characters to hold up to some sort of false ideal of proper good behavior. And so I sort of married those sensibilities. I kind of pitched it as a boozy, Englishy, cable-y update of Mad About You.
And how would you describe the main characters, Jimmy and Gretchen?
I think they're both narcissists. They probably have substance abuse problems to a certain extent. They're both pretty good at their jobs, but they're incredibly self-involved and are sort of completely uninterested in their own psychology, or in Jimmy's case, too interested in his own psychology. They don't follow normal societal rules. They talk in movie theaters. They are mean to kind of everyone they come across if they deserve it. They kind of think everyone is dumb and annoying. And yet they very much love each other and think of themselves as a little team against the world. But really, I mean, they just sort of stand in for the dark parts of all of us that are still deserving of love at the end of the day.
Stephen, one thing that works for them as a couple is that they start out by telling each other all the horrible things they've done at the beginning. They think, you know, why lie about it if it's going to be a one-night stand? Get all the garbage, all of the horrible stuff out there early on. Do either of you have any experiences you want to share about that time, you know, that beginning of a relationship when you're figuring out what to share with someone or how to kind of craft what you want the other person to think you are?
No, thank you. No, I am. Yeah, I mean, I think we perform different sides of ourselves in different situations and with different people. And I think when you're interested in someone romantically, there's a tendency to sort of try to show the good parts first. You know, bait and switch is a term that's used often. I feel like we think we have to hide certain parts of ourselves, but the truth is that the things that you fall in love with are usually not the things that you're first presenting. The reasons why you, I think intimacy is created through vulnerability and through showing sides of yourself that you don't necessarily think are the best. So it's a misunderstanding of how we fall in love. Personally, I'm a very patient person. I tend to date people who show me a lot up front that would make people run away. I had a boyfriend get arrested a couple dates in. I had a boyfriend pee in my roommate's closet a couple dates in. Actually, that's the same guy. And he ended up being a wonderful, wonderful human. And we dated for 2 years, but it all happened within the first month.
I went back and watched the first episode, and out of the gate, there's a lot of sex on the show. There isn't nudity, really, but there's sex, but it's integral to the story and to the characters. Stephen, why did you want to include that aspect into the series?
Well, if it's if you're going to have a show about romantic relationships, I think sex is integral to that. I think we're a bizarrely puritanical culture. American pop culture has gone in a really odd direction where sex is usually portrayed either as just for titillation, both in movies and TV, or it's treated like deeply, deeply seriously and with all the sort of sexiness of it stripped out. And that always really bothered me. And every time I, you know, got the opportunity to do sex scenes on Weeds, to write them, I did, because I think it's a great joy of being alive and being a human.
Aya, what did you think when you saw those scenes in that first episode? I would think it could be something uncomfortable to do.
I mean, I want to answer that with, yeah, I mean, like, I'm cool with it, and I had no reaction. And I think philosophically, I'm very much on the same page as Stephen. But in reality, I was like, oh, God, no. I mean, it's terrifying to do. And I had never done them before, and I'd been very specific about not doing nudity and not auditioning for stuff like that, mainly because it is so, it, you know, as a lady, you get asked to take your clothes off all the time, and I think most of it is pretty unnecessary. Because I thought this script was so interesting and good, and I sort of understood the point of the sex scene, I got on board. But that doesn't mean I didn't have normal sort of human insecurities and anxieties about it. I remember sort of getting the nudity writer and being like, what nudity writer? We're on FX. What? And they were like, well, you can show side boob and butt. And I said, okay, you get side boob, but show his butt. I think that was the agreement we came to for the pilot. So, you know, it's a scary thing, and maybe I'm just a product of the culture that I live in, but I was definitely sort of nervous about it. Doing it is different because all the lead up is sort of neuroses, and then you get there and you just, everything normalizes. I don't feel super uncomfortable once we're doing that, because it's with people that I like and trust, and your arm hurts because you're lying back on it for 2 hours and your feet go numb, and, you know, it's not sexy at all.
We're listening to the interview that Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with Aya Cash, the co-star of the FXX series You're the Worst, and Stephen Falk, the creator of the series. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the School of the New York Times, offering a symposium on college admissions and preparation for students and parents with industry experts and admissions professionals on October 8th at the Times Center or by live stream at nytedu.com. And from Carbonite, a cloud backup and restore solution for office and home computers. Learn more at carbonite.com.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with Stephen Falk, creator of the FXX series You're the Worst, and Aya Cash, the co-star of the series.
Now, Aya, your parents are both artists, and you've mm-hmm. said that you grew up thinking being an artist was a viable career. It didn't have to be about fame and fortune. You know, you can be mm-hmm. kind of a worker artist. Can you talk about growing up in San Francisco with artist parents and how that affected what you thought being an artist would be?
Yeah, my dad was he did street theater with a group called the Pageant Players. They used to go on in the intermission of the Living Theater, and the Living Theater would scream, "Give them all your money, you bourgeois pigs," because Pageant Players were like more underground than the Living Theater. So he did that for a while. He played in a Balinesian gamelan for many years, which is like a Balinesian orchestra, and traveled around the world during that. He then was a musician playing flute and some light drug dealing. Hi, Dad. And very, very minimal. nothing hard. And then met my mom by fixing her flute because he fixed instruments. Then he became a therapist briefly, and now he's a Buddhist teacher and lay priest. If that's not an artistic life, I don't really know what is. So he taught me, one, that money wasn't important. Neither of my parents were money driven, and that life is not necessarily about the things that our culture tells you that they're about. And that's a very privileged point of view. My mom is a poet and a novelist and a memoirist. She would kill me if I was on Fresh Air and didn't say her full name and her new book. Kim Adonizio, Bukowski in a Sundress, is her new book. She also has a book of poems called Mortal Trash. There you go, Mom. By the way, my mom's reaction and my husband's reaction to going on Fresh Air was the same thing. Was, oh my God, f- you. Because they both would love to be on Fresh Air. So anyway, my mom is...
At least
is,
it was in that order.
Yeah, yeah. They were very excited for me, and we hate you. So my mom, my entire life, was a writer. And so, again, never about money. She really didn't sell out at any point. I remember people being like, you should write a screenplay, or you should write a this or do that. And she just did her own thing. If she needed money, she wrote. I mean, she was in Penthouse with an erotic short story because it paid really well. You know, she did things to pay the bills, but she's always stuck to her artistic vision and what she thinks is important, as opposed to what anyone else tells her is important or valuable. And I really respect that.
Now, Aya, your training, you've done a lot of theater, and your training was more for acting on the stage. And like you were saying, You're the Worst is a comedy, but it's a comedy-drama meld. I've read you talk in an interesting way about the difference between doing crying or sad scenes on stage versus for TV and film, specifically talking about Shakespeare and how you have to cry for Shakespeare. Can you talk about the difference of playing more dramatic roles for the stage versus for the TV show?
Yeah, well, I think in both, if it doesn't say in a line, I'm crying, or, oh, I'm so sorry, did I get you wet with my tears kind of thing, I try not to, you never want to make a choice to cry. That's sort of not, nobody's going like, let me force these tears out in real life. It's sort of something that happens. So you want to stay sort of in the moment and let that happen or not happen, as opposed to pushing it. On stage, you get a very long runway. So if you start at the beginning of a play, you have an hour maybe to get to a scene that you're having a huge emotional breakdown of being in that character and just sort of going straight through. It's like you sort of get on the ride and then get off at the end of the night. Film and TV is so, you do these little truncated bits, sometimes a couple lines at a time. We had there's a scene in one of the episodes where I sort of go off on everyone. That was maybe a 4-page scene that we would do in one. So sometimes you get a little lead up, but it's definitely not the same experience as going from minute one and then finishing a play. And so I find that sort of harder to do. You know, the thing about TV is there's editing too. So if you screw up a line or if you mess something up, they're going to take the best lines from the best takes and put it together. I mean, I do think that television is in many ways, the actor is the least important and yet the most lauded, because you can really craft a performance in the editing suite. I mean, not to discount that you need to bring something, but it's very manipulatable. So you also have to trust that and not get mad at yourself. If you stumble in a theater show, you know, you got to sort of just get back on the wagon and keep going. But if you stumble in TV, you get to do it again. And that's a luxury that I have also enjoyed, that, you know, they're going to, and trust that they're going to pick the best.
Another one of the strengths of You're the Worst of the supporting characters, Edgar, who is Jimmy's best friend, and Lindsay, who's Gretchen's best friend. I want to play a quick scene between those two friends, played by Heather Donahue and Desmond Voorhees. They have asked for all four of the friends for all of them to go out to dinner together, and they've now been stood up a few times already. And Lindsay is wondering why their friends, Jimmy and Gretchen, don't seem to care about them.
Why are they treating us like this?
Lindsay, I think we're sidekicks.
Ew, I am not a sidekick. I'm Beyonce, not Kelly Rowland. If I'm on a motorcycle, I'm driving the motorcycle, not riding in that little side motorcycle thingy for poor people and dogs.
Think about it. In your relationship with Gretchen, are you the Mary Tyler Moore or the Rhoda?
Who are those people? They sound ugly.
Okay, and flipping out, on Bravo, ooh, are you the Jeff Lewis or the Jenny, we don't know her last name?
Oh my God. I am totally the Jenny, we don't know her last name. Actually, I do, it's Poulos, I'm a big fan.
That's a scene from You're the Worst. Stephen Falk, can you talk about the supporting, they're more than that, but the best friend characters, Edgar and Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, I love playing with form. And I think, like, when I remember when I first, I probably read or saw Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard. It's this play that takes two very minor characters in Hamlet and sort of makes them the central to their own story, and everything that goes on in Hamlet is happening sort of around them, and they're witnessing it. And I thought that was an incredibly interesting shift. So that's sort of where that idea of sidekicks becoming self-aware came. I mean, there's this trope in when you have a rom-com, you need confidants. You know, it goes back to Shakespeare and probably before that. Juliet has her nurse. You know, you need someone who is working behind the scenes as a sounding board and giving advice and making liaisons happen. And it's just kind of built into the form. But that always then kind of rankled with me, the idea that someone would sort of exist just to be subordinate to someone is not really how anyone lives their life. And I mean, I'm sure Smithers has his own, he's central to his own drama, and not just a sidekick to Mr. Burns. So that was what interested me about that, of taking, okay, well, I need Jimmy and Gretchen to be able to talk to someone about their budding relationship, but at the same time, the dramatist in me couldn't have those characters just be sidekicks. So I wanted them to have some sort of self-awareness in that. And it's a little bit of a meta moment, but it helped springboard them into their own storylines.
Stephen Falk and Aya Cash, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Stephen Falk is the creator of the FXX series You're the Worst. Aya Cash is the co-star. They spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. The new HBO series Westworld premieres Sunday. John Powers will review it after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. On Sunday night, HBO premieres Westworld, a new futuristic series starring Anthony Hopkins, Evan Rachel Wood, and James Marsden. Adapted from the 1973 movie Westworld, it's about a high-tech theme park whose visitors get to live out their wildest dreams of being in the Old West. Our critic at large, John Powers, has seen the first few episodes and says that the show has a lot more on its mind than you may expect.
I have a friend in London who's at war with her car's GPS. Although she nearly always puts it on, she's driven mad by its voice, which is female, and refuses to follow its directions. She spends whole trips arguing with, barking at, and sometimes cursing this imaginary woman. She'd never be this rude to an actual human being. But of course, a GPS doesn't have feelings. But what if it did? That's one of the many timely questions raised by Westworld, the darkly exciting new series that's HBO's biggest gamble since Game of Thrones. Developed by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, it's an ambitious reboot and rethink of the clever but clunky 1973 movie by Michael Crichton, who would go on to write the more popular but less provocative Jurassic Park. The show takes its title from the name of a futuristic theme park, where visitors come to live out their Wild West fantasies. Inhabited by astonishingly lifelike androids known as hosts, Westworld lets guests ride the high country, gun down an outlaw, fall for a cowboy, or bed a beautiful bar girl, all with no risk. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the park is run by a huge team, topped by its genius creator, Dr. Robert Ford, played by Anthony Hopkins, its lead programmer, Bernard Lowe, that's Jeffrey Wright, and tough Teresa Cullen, who represents corporate, which has sinister plans of its own. She's played by Cincy Babbitt-Knudsen from Borgen. Everything goes smoothly until there's a glitch in the android's operating system. Triggered by an apt line from Romeo and Juliet, "These violent delights have violent ends," some of the hosts begin acting out in nasty ways. Not to give anything away, but this makes matters tricky for everyone, from Westworld's management to a scary, ultra-violent repeat guest known as Gunslinger. That's Ed Harris of the Chilling Blue Eyes. At the center of the action are William, a nice guy tourist played by Jimmy Simpson, and the show's heroine, Dolores Abernathy. Brilliantly played by Evan Rachel Wood, she's a rancher's daughter who discovers that life is a lot more complicated than she ever realized. Here, Jeffrey Wright's character, Bernard, meets with Hopkins's pensive, almost Olympian Dr. Ford to discuss why the androids have taken to misbehaving.
So our creatures have been misbehaving. You haven't yet isolated the bug. That's so unlike you, Bernard. Unless, of course, you have and are simply embarrassed by the result.
It's the code you added, sir. The reveries. It has some...
Mistakes is the word you're too embarrassed to use. You ought not to be a product of a trillion of them. The evolution forged the entirety of sentient life on this planet using only one tool. The mistake.
Now, Westworld is clearly a big-budget production, filled with big-name performers. I haven't even mentioned Tandy Newton's sexy madam, or James Marsden's preeningly romantic gunslinger. And its nifty production design lovingly recreates the Old West, Hollywood style, and gives us the cool, soullessly sterile labs where scientists continually program and rebuild murdered androids. As you might guess, the series asks us to think about our relationship to technology, in particular to machines that come ever closer to displaying human intelligence and emotions, as the android hosts do here. After all, it's one thing for a techno genie to satisfy our needs, quite another for it to have needs of its own. What if we create beings that can grow beyond our ability to know and control them? In Crichton's original film, the human heroes are threatened by run-amok androids. This new version flips that idea, conjuring a reality in which the androids are abused by human beings. It joins a long tradition that sympathizes with man-made creatures, like Boris Karloff's Frankenstein, who was as touching as he was scary. And it joins movies like Blade Runner and the recent Ex Machina in suggesting that fabricated creatures may be smarter, more passionate, and indeed more profoundly alive than the people who made and enslaved them. At bottom, this unexpectedly resonant show isn't really about technology, but about the human soul, whose operating system has a glitch that some call original sin. Watching Westworld's guests exploit the hosts for their many different pleasures, I found myself thinking about tourism in our own world, where travelers often treat foreign lands as theme parks and locals as disposable extras. Think of Ryan Lochte in Rio. Or even worse, visit exotic countries to buy easy, cheap sex or slaughter their animals for sport. Bursting with violent delights and violent ends, Westworld is shot through with a melancholy truth, that nothing is more human than behaving inhumanly.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like our interviews with Antoine Fuqua, the director of The Magnificent Seven, Peter Berg, the director of Deepwater Horizon, and Washington Post reporter David Farenthold, who is investigating the Donald J. Trump Foundation, check out our podcast. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Thea Chaloner. Teresa Madden directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization offering educational travel adventures for families, grandparents, and grandchildren. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from Squarespace, an all-in-one website builder and domain registrar with Whois Privacy and other features. Learn more at squarespace.com/domains.